Campus Podcast, amplifying the voices of college inclusion innovators. I'm your host, Sabby Labor, founder and CEO of Resilient Campus. Join me each week as I interview professionals on the front lines of campus and community movement building. For more information, please visit resilientcampus.com/podcast. Episode number 3 of the Resilient Campus Podcast. Today we're speaking with Jason Jackson from the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. Jason serves as a multicultural education coordinator and teaching specialist for the leadership minor. Jason received his undergraduate degree in communication studies and his master's of arts in organizational leadership and policy development with a focus in higher education. Jason, thanks so much for being here today. I heart you and welcome you to the podcast.
Yay, I'm so happy to be here. Thank you, Sabby.
So Jason and I go way back here in the lovely city of Minneapolis. We squeeze each other real hard every time we see each other. So I'm so happy to have you on. And I really think that you are brilliant and humble and just someone that I want to be around. So I know that other people are going to really want to be around you as well and be connected with your network. So Jason, I know that that bio and even my glowing recommendations of you don't really cover all that you are. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, first of all, you're going to make me smear my mascara with my cheers because you're all like being so sweet to me. But thank you. And I admire you too. And I'm really proud of the work you're doing with Resilient Campus.
Thank you.
A little about me. Who am I? I don't know. Jason Jackson, and I use he and him pronouns. And, you know, currently I'm at the University of Minnesota, and I've been a staff member at the university now since 2012, a little over 5 years, I think, at this point. And I'm serving as the Multicultural Education Coordinator in the Academic Department, the Leadership Minor. I've been in this role for almost a year now. I'm in love with it. I am originally from Dallas, Texas, so I am a Texas Bama, like our Queen Beyonce. And I grew up in the South, grew up in Atlanta as well, and lived in New York City. And I have been living now in Minneapolis for the last 9 years. I think I'm officially a Minnesotan. Is that right? I think. I don't know what that means. I don't know anymore. I think that I'm going to have to resist the Minnesotan because I still walk around these streets in the Twin Cities with flashy clothes when I can and a sassy attitude that is unapologetic. So maybe not Minnesota. So I do have a love for Minnesota or Minneapolis for the most part. But yeah, I've been here for a while now. It's kind of weird to even say 9 years because I did not think that was going to happen.
Nice. Which identities are most salient for you today?
You know, it all depends on the day. It depends on the hour. I think a lot about right now teaching and the work that I do teaching. And I've been really thinking about my identify as he and him pronouns, a male identified person, same in my gender, identify as a man in my culture. But I've been thinking a lot about my femininity a lot lately. You know, I just turned 35 years old and I came out like over 20 years ago. I was 14. And I think about my role in teaching. I think about the ways in which students perceive my gender expression and my femininity when I move through the classroom, when I'm teaching. And I oftentimes think that my femininity and the way in which I express my femininity, being a Black gay man, comes from a very fierce place. I've been thinking a lot about that lately. I thought about that more so as I hit the age of 35 a couple of months ago and I went home to Dallas. And I've been thinking a lot about going home and also where I really think I learned femininity from my mom, from my sister, older sister, from my grandmother. And all those women in my family exuded strength. And so with me, I carry a lot of that femininity too. And sometimes I think a lot about femininity more so now as I'm teaching, as I'm doing my work at the university and how people perceive me. Is it off-putting to people? Is it scary to people? But how I feel about my own sense of self right now, particularly with femininity or my gender expression anyway, is really unapologetic. You know, I think I fought my entire life resisting that gender expression. And as I get older and have a better, not a full sense, but a better sense of self, I start to think about what it means to sit in my own skin, my own body unapologetically. And it's a beautiful feeling, right? It's a really empowering feeling. But again, I've been thinking a lot about it because as I'm comfortable, I know that some people around me are uncomfortable, right? And I know that's not my issue. I know that's their stuff, but I'm really fascinated by it still. Even at 35 years old.
How does that influence or interplay with how you serve students or how you do your work in college environments?
There's always roles that we all play, just in general, right? I mean, I often talk about the concept of like code switching or really knowing your audience and your environment. When I'm with my family, I'm a certain way. When I'm around students, and particularly in a college environment, I know that I do have a high expectation for students. And I also have high expectations for my colleagues, faculty and staff alike. And with that, particularly with students in my classroom, with students that I'm just serving and supporting and mentoring or advising, I know that the role that I find myself oftentimes playing is like kind of like Aunt P. A little bit, like in my head, it's like I'm like the aunt, right? Mm-hmm. The aunt is going to give it to you straight. He's going to, you know, give it to you with love, with fierce love, I like to say, and being unapologetic. So I do think that that kind of role that I find myself playing at the University of Minnesota, particularly with students of all races and all genders, that kind of auntie persona kind of comes out. Like, this is real talk. You know, you're paying money to be here. Your education will open doors for you, but you also have a responsibility with the privileges that you have. And you can feel it, right? Like, you can feel their, like, many of their responses to it with a sense of respect. Some students I work with look at me like, what the hell? I get it, but I don't get it, right? It's just a really funny way of interacting with them.
I really appreciate that you're sharing that. I think that I've had this interesting experience watching students and myself in these environments where, you know, we serve as role models and mentors, and they're always watching what we do and always, you know, looking for that next skill, that next tool, or that next piece of language, or however, like, to add to their toolkit, if you will, or their own capacity building set or series. I've noticed that, like, especially with male identified students, you know, whether it's in the K-12 or the higher education environment, they're kind of interested in these really rigid ideas of masculinity. And so as folks who are assigned a particular sex at birth and then kind of playing with gender in their expression and in their, you know, identities, and just being upfront and super real about that, I think that students are able to work through their own identity in a way that is not as confined, not as rigid. So I feel like you know, embracing and truly walking authentically in your feminine identity and your feminine expression, and just being real with students about that, is a real value add, because they're able to see the fluidity of gender. And, you know, you're a professional in these roles. They could be a professional in these roles one day too. I think it opens doors. I think it's one of the ways that we model what the possibilities are for folks when they're kind of navigating, who am I? Where am I going to be, you know, after college or when I grow up? You know, these big questions. So I appreciate that you share that, because it's something I think about.
Yeah, I 120% agree, because I was thinking, right, like, even with how, you know, with my identify, how I was assigned at birth and how I moved through my femininity in a feminine way, I think that 20 years ago, students may have had a very different reaction, particularly the young, like, cisgender men, college-age students, or even, like you mentioned, K-12 as well, may have had a harder time navigating it. But the world has changed so dramatically, right, for the good and for the bad. I do think now, me being able to express myself with the teaching, advising, et cetera, I do really believe that the world has changed and the minds and the ideas have changed, where they're much more nimble around it. And I remember even thinking about the concept, like you're talking about, of what does it mean to be in professional roles? And I think when I was growing up, a high school teacher, and she cursed like a sailor. And I was always taught, right, that professionals didn't do that. But I had a new role model who spoke authentically, right, when she cursed. But she did it in a way that was, there was always reason behind it. And it was done with ease. And I started to even question these ideas around professionalism. And as I got older, those rigid ways of thinking about professionalism, I started looking at other professionals, right, who were being themselves fully, mm-hmm. who were not always in suits and ties and skirts and all that fun stuff. And they were drastically different. I was really starting to critique and carve out my own path now for what it means to be a professional, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't have to buy into the respectability politics of that world. And what a beautiful world to kind of be in now to even practice and interrogate those mm-hmm. ideals right now. So anyway, you got me thinking, which is always the case with you, Savvy. So whatever.
That's amazing. You know, funny story. So Jason, it might have been the second or third time we met, but I remember when I invited you to talk at the institution where I was working, And you were working on this really cool project, and you were doing the queer Black history of the Twin Cities. And I remember right off the bat, you dropped an F-bomb, like right when you were leading the session. And it was hilarious because I'm kind of scanning the room because I'm in the audience. And people left that session, no matter how, you know, in Minnesota, they tried to hide and try to be real, you know, real coy about like, I'm not reacting to this at all. You know, you could read that their body language shifted a little bit. But by the end of it, I feel like they were reconciling their own understandings of like who are credible sources of information. They came up to me afterwards and for days upon end afterwards saying that was an amazing presentation. I remember, you know, folks were coming up from like archives and exhibits wanting to collaborate with you. For me, it just reiterated, it's just another thing I'll put in the like checkbox for the evidence that being who we are, it really adds value in these education environments.
It really, really does. A Black Queer History Project is sitting still with more meat being added to it as we speak in the Cheddar Archives at the University of Minnesota. But when I was presenting that, I mean, imagine what it would have meant if I didn't get an opportunity to experience and to play out my fullness. So I was really passionate about that project. I was really passionate about the work that was going into it, right? And by dropping the F-bomb in that moment, it needed to happen for the room to really feel the weight of oppression of Black queerness and transness in the state of Minnesota.
Completely agree. Jason, tell us a little bit about the inclusion work that you're doing today in the Leadership Minor.
As a multicultural education coordinator, first and foremost, I love it because I get a chance to hire and develop adjunct instructors in this program of the Leadership Minor. So the Leadership Minor, you know, there's like four different courses the students take in order to receive an actual minor in the program or once they graduate. And so I hire on now and develop some of the instructors, and we do it through an adjunct-based model. So those who have their master's degree, those who are kind of being around or have completed like their doctorate, some of them come in and just do adjunct work. And we train them on like the pedagogy of teaching through this idea of intentional emergence, which in a shorter version basically means that you come in with your intentions and your work, your lesson plans, you have everything ready, you know what you're going to teach in terms of the concepts of leadership. Then there are these emergent moments that you have it in the world that we live in, like the election, like police shooting. Also emerging moments coming with the students, their personal experiences. They come in and maybe they've lost a parent. And that becomes a conversation, right? And so the intentionally emergent pedagogy speaks to how do we actually use the resources that are at hand to teach leadership concept. So it's really, it's beautiful work because it's proxies. It's really like talking about theory and actually practicing it in the moment in the classroom. So we have different tasks and all that. But we actually hire adjunct instructors to facilitate those really powerful moments in the classroom. And that's what I get an opportunity to do. So that's one of them, as well as developing training for them. I'm really centered in the work of social justice, as you probably already knew, in identity work. And I'm one of those people who I take my job seriously because if you're going to be, and I wish this was the case for all faculty, I'm not going to lie, but if all faculty would take a moment to really reassess what it means to think about systems of oppression, how we perpetuate white supremacy, how we perpetuate heteronormativity in the classroom. And I'm really big on making sure that our adjunct instructors are very, very aware of what that means. And when you get hired on to be an instructor in a leadership minor, you have that responsibility to be very, very mindful about what that means. So I developed training to really help coach them through navigating microaggressions, identity development in the classroom. I wish, again, I can't say it enough, I wish more faculty had that. And I also co-write curriculum for the intro level class. And what I've been able to recently do with the leadership minor is to really center the work of power and privilege and systems of oppression and identity work towards the heart and the meat of the class. And those conversations are so incredibly important. And I also know that those conversations and readings that they're doing are very scary for some, but they are a reality for a lot of students every single day. And so when I'm thinking about curriculum writing and I'm writing curriculum, I'm always asking that question. I'm like, who am I serving? Who am I protecting? Who am I letting off the hook? And how can I bring instructors up to a level where they need to be in a world that is changing very rapidly, that is extremely political, that is very, very tense time, right? Mm-hmm. This work is more important than ever. When we talk about leadership, we got to talk about social justice. We've got to talk about white supremacy and liberation. Those are so critical. I do some of that work in writing some of the curriculum for the intro level class and leadership minor. And I do a whole lot of other stuff, right? Connecting with other faculty on campus, doing collaborative programming around leadership concepts and theory and topics and all that fun stuff. So it is a blast.
Yeah. And you know, what's really interesting about the role that you have is you're kind of liaising between all these different worlds, right? I mean, within the university environment, you're asking faculty to do things that they don't necessarily have to do, right? When I think about my experience on the student affairs side of the house, asking faculty to do things is usually a request. It's like, hey, we have this relationship. Would you consider doing this? What are those? That's from my experience. I don't mean to put words in your mouth. You know, for other college professionals who are navigating, you know, these similar university and college environments where they might have the opportunity to work with faculty and kind of embedding these social justice values and topics and concerns. Do you have any advice for them? What leads you to have effective conversations across the aisle, if you will, with faculty around inclusion and social justice issues in their curriculum, essentially?
We walk into this work immediately thinking that there is a huge split, because it feels like it almost college campuses, between student affairs professionals and faculty, right, at colleges and universities across the U.S. I can speak out only anyway. That's not always the case. There's plenty of faculty that I would identify, even at the University of Minnesota, who are ready and willing to talk about the ways in which gender and sexuality and race and class are impacting their students' learning and how they're teaching the classroom. There can be a split, but it's not across the board. Mm-hmm. Another thing I think student affairs professionals must realize, and this is so important because I've talked about this, you mentioned this idea around code switching. Well, if you're going to, like, connect with faculty and have the opportunity to connect with faculty. To me, the idea around student affairs is we cannot be siloed and just sitting and like supporting students and inviting students. We also have to get our head in the game of like academic knowledge. We gotta be looking at like and make it a case and a point to read at least 3 or 4 scholarly articles on any given topic throughout the week, just to have at my disposal. So then when I'm engaging with, I may start off with my very mushy student affairs, like lovey-dovey side. And if they're not buying it, then I have to break into like measurements and theory and name dropping some of the scholarly people. We've got to keep our head in that game too, if we want to really make those connections with faculty. So I think that to me is really critical and really key. Also, like you mentioned before, like some faculty, not all, but some faculty, you're right. They don't have to come to certain trainings on diversity, equity, and inclusion. They don't have to. But as a student affairs professional, I think that you have to stay grounded in the fact of it being a critical thing. I think that you have to stay grounded in the fact that as the world is changing, you have to truly believe it. And you have to be pushy. And you've got to push, right? Again, if they're facing students twice a week for 16 weeks out of the semester, there's no way in hell conversations or issues or feelings of biases and discrimination and prejudice are not coming up in the classroom. Mm-hmm. So you got to be really pushy. And if you don't have a case study, look at the world around you to have conversations with faculty. Look at our political landscape. It's kind of a storm, right? It really is. And so those are some of the things I have to really think about. I do think that at the end of the day, in order to kind of navigate the other side of the aisle, as you mentioned, I think it starts with us student affairs professionals. We've got to get in the work of academia ourselves. We get comfortable in that world, but we've got to make it in the world of student affairs and all that. But we've got to get into a lot of academic worlds and spaces ourselves in the work, especially if we see students holistically.
I talk with a lot of student affairs professionals who are really interested in teaching, and they just can't seem to find that open door because it's such a discipline-focused hiring process. How do they get into teaching? Do you have any recommendations for them?
Yes and no. Yes, because I do that, right? Like I came directly from student affairs professional world. I was finishing up my graduate work at the U, and my last professor told me about this program, the Leadership Minor, which is what I'm very fortunate to work for right now, about this program where they do take adjuncts, where folks do not have to have had their like degree specifically in leadership, but the idea that leadership can be taught. So that was really my way in. I would also say, and that's the beauty and the tragedy of student affairs professionals wanting to get involved in doing more teaching. You have to do some of the grant work of doing adjunct work and maybe not getting paid a crap ton of money to do it, but that experience is essential. And so another thing, I went over to Minneapolis Community and Technical College and talked to them about some of their adjunct positions and what that would mean for someone like me to do it. But usually you, of course, will have to, you know, if you study communications, you may have a great opportunity to teach a comm studies class at a community college. So I think those spaces, speaking of community college, where there's a lot of students of color and non-traditional age students, that could be an amazing place to do some of that work. But reach out, get out of your own silo. If you're at McAllister, Hamline, the university, start reaching out to people randomly. Do it all the time. It's weird, but it's also extremely important. Reach out to someone at community college to start to figure out ways to get your foot in the door that way. So that's the best advice. But the leadership minor, I know now, is definitely looking for more folks who have their master's or their PhDs already to teach in the leadership minor class as an adjunct faculty member. So if you're curious about that, do www.lead@umn.edu, and you can find information there about the adjunct work that we're doing over at the university, how you can be an instructor and get teaching experience there.
Great. And I'll put that link in the show notes so that people can just click on it and find out more information. How did you arrive to the work that you're doing today?
It found me. I never looked for it. Trust me. So like I mentioned, I'm from Dallas and I grew up in Atlanta and then moved to New York City. You know, it was in that place of finding myself, you know. I found a lot of stuff in New York City, when probably not Jason Jackson, but I learned a lot about Jason Jackson in New York City. But when I moved to the Twin Cities 9 years ago, in a personal way, that was the biggest culture shock, right? Because I had never been in an urban center that was so predominantly white. Like there was, I was like sticking out. I was like, where are the black people at? Where y'all hiding? And I was like, you know, look through like the LGBT magazine and I wouldn't see people of color. And I would, you know, go out and I would see sprinkles of us, but it was really hard to find community. Now at that time when I had moved to Minneapolis, I was finishing my undergraduate degree at the university. And I knew that if I was having a hard time navigating just all of who I was as a queer black person, I can only imagine what younger people are feeling at the university, what other transplants are feeling in the university. So I worked with a friend of mine and he and I started or revamped this kind of group called Tongues Untied that was for queer LGBT students of color. And from there, I became really loud on campus when I started getting a whole bunch of LGBT people together. And they started talking about their experiences, and I just became loud, unapologetic on campus. And I ended up graduating from the university. I worked in the St. Paul Public School District as an LGBT assistant coordinator and working with a lot of LGBT youth in St. Paul. But that really didn't feel like a good fit for me because I do think that I was I don't want to say radical person because me being radical is just like me putting on shoes. It's a normal thing, I think, in many ways. But I was more of a forward-thinking person, and I wasn't used to working with people who needed permission slips, to be honest with you. It was hard, right? I'll be very frank with you. I was really, at the time, working in the St. Paul Public Schools or K-12, pushing the agenda of talking about queer and trans sex education, because I knew that there wasn't sex education happening already. The general hetero way for me to have me. So what does that mean for us? And what does that mean when I keep hearing about the large number of STIs that are impacting the queer and trans community, particularly the folks of color? And so I was frustrated. I'm like, mm-hmm. We've got to have something where we talk about safe sex, you know, for the high school students in particular, because I know they're out doing it and we've got to do it. And I was getting a lot of pushback because it was like, well, we need permission slips. We're going to have phone calls if we do it. And that was frustrating because I knew that these students, and I needed it, hell, myself, growing up, I needed to know. I needed somebody to, in a way, normalize the fact that the sex I was having was not the sex that was shameful. I was, in my own way, pushy. I'm like, we're going to do this anyway. And guess what? Everything was fine. No parents were called. School didn't get through. And the students actually asked questions to the professional sex educator that we brought in. And it was actually a beautiful conversation. Like, students asked real questions that you can tell that they were embarrassed to ask. When they asked the questions, they got what they needed. Long story short, the University of Minnesota called me because, again, I'm loud and I'm running around town, like, advocating for queer issues and POC stuff and organizing. And they called me for a position working as an administrator, assistant director at the what was known as the GLBTA programs office at the University of Minnesota. They've recently changed their name to the Gender and Sexuality Center for Queer and Trans Life. And I served in that role for about 4.5 years. And while I was working with college students and doing, like, really intense conversations, particularly for people of color who are queer and trans, I was also going into graduate school because I knew that I was being called to do this work for higher education, to work with college students. Other people were seeing my talents. I was feeling good about the work I was doing. So why not get my master's? Because if I'm going to stay and do this work, I got to have the credibility. And also being a Black queer person too, I knew that my luck would run out if I wasn't good just on paper. My personality, my loudness wasn't going to get me in those spaces where I can make more effective changes. And I hated that concept, but that was something I knew I needed to do. I had to jump through a hoop. And so I did it. I got my master's and I did well. And so I kept doing the work at the University of Minnesota. And the kind of work that I was really pushing for is that I knew that around the country, the LGBT center, the majority of people who were taking advantage of those programs were mostly white, queer, and trans folks. I knew that. And I knew that because the majority and almost all of the staff at the majority of all of these colleges and universities across the country were white staff. And I'm Black, and I'm going to bring queer and trans people of color to that program in a really intentional way. I'm going to serve them like I was hired to do. I will have to say that, you know, the retention of people who are accessing our programming, anything from sexual health to student groups to organizations to welcoming ceremonies and graduation ceremonies for LGBT people, the number of people of color were increasing. And it was a beautiful thing to see, right? And to the point where I got, you know, working in that position for about 4.5 years, I knew when my time to leave was there. I knew I needed to do something different. And I also knew that I needed to move out of that seat because there were some other powerful people of color who were queer and trans who needed to be in that seat to do the things that I couldn't do and bring a new voice and a new life to the work. So again, when I say that the work of, like, social justice and education and student advocacy found me, it literally found me. Because when I was doing that work toward the end of working at the LGBT office, I had gotten I got mentioned to you that I was told about this program to be an instructor, and I was taking advantage of it. I was a busy person. I forget how busy I was now I think about it. I started teaching, and then the leadership minor called, right? And they were like, we want you to come. And I'm like, you know, to get the opportunity to teach and to build curriculum is another important asset I needed to survive in the jungle of higher education. So when I talked about earlier, when you asked, how do you bridge that divide from the other aisle? Well, this is another great way of doing it. I can now talk to faculty about the work that I'm doing and have a real conversation about why we have to center and why we have to make sure that we're being really equitable in our classrooms, why this stuff is extremely important. I've seen a lot of crap, and I've also been hurt a lot in the work. I've been burnt out a lot in the work. I've cried a lot in the work. But there's something in me, and I think each and every one of us who's been listening to this podcast now, if you know that you have a calling to do the work to change the world, or just to change a student, or to change perspective, stay in it. Right? I oftentimes think about the concept of self-care and how, you know, even that can be framed from a very, like, white-centered place. But as people of color, we do have to make sure that we stop as we're able, as we can. But also at the same time, we got to really pay attention to the work that we're called to do. And now more than ever, student affairs and professionals who are folks of color, who are in other, like, minoritized identities, women, queer and trans folks, disabled folks, indigenous folks. Like, we've got to be at the table because we have a lot of our students who are entering higher education and expecting to have their minds blown, and they're going to be our new leader. We've got to be at that table. And so pay attention to that calling. I swear, that is such an important thing to me. So no matter how frustrated I get, how tired I get, how burnt I get by the work, I know that this is what I have to be doing.
So Jason, you know, when I think about how amazing you are and how brilliant you are, and I love hearing that you have like 3 to 4 articles at hand, you know, when you're doing this work, bridging the divide with faculty, building those collaborations. What's that one book or podcast or resource that informs how you approach your work or how you think about your work?
I was thinking about podcasts earlier. Can I? Okay, so you remember I was talking to you about self-care is really important. Okay, well, I am not gonna lie. Sometimes I listen to podcasts or certain TV shows, reality TV shows, because sometimes I have to turn my brain off, real talk. And I also do it strategically because I know the students are watching some of these things. And sometimes I use it as a case study for life, whatever. But I have to turn my brain off. I was thinking about podcasts. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's called The Read. Oh, it's terribly beautiful, but it's basically about, it's like this one gay black guy and a woman, and they're like talking about celebrity gossip. It's terrible, but I love it. It's so fun. And it also reminds me to laugh, right? Cause you gotta laugh through life with the world that we're living in. You have to. One thing that has really more so reinvigorated my work and reinvigorated the way in which I connect with people, how I write, how I teach, is the kind of like prelude. It was in James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time. And what it is, it's a letter to his nephew. And it appears in like the Progressive magazine in 1962. You can check it out online. But it's like a couple pages. And it's written in 1962. So this is like 100 years after the Civil War, and after like slaves were like free from shackles, not from oppression, but free from shackles specifically. And this was written about 6 years ago. And if I could read like a piece of it, would you mind?
No, I love that.
There's just like a couple of lines in here. And this, again, this is written like, you know, what, 60 something years ago. And it has such relevance to today. And really what he's talking about with his nephew is, what is the world that you're living in right now? And how do you, I think what he's asking his nephew or encouraging him to do is to remind yourself to have empathy for people in a world that is so extremely volatile, that is so extremely racist. I would translate that into a world that is still very much so extremely transphobic and queerphobic and ableist and you name it. But there's a couple of lines I want to just briefly read. And he writes to his nephew. He says that you must accept them. And I think about them, those people who hate, and accept them with love. But these innocent people have no other hope. They are, in effect, still trapped in a history when they do not understand. And until they understand it, they cannot be released from it. He kind of goes on in here, and he says this, and I can never get this imagery out of my head. He says, try to imagine how you would feel if you woke up one morning to find the sun shivering and all of the stars aflame. You would be frightened because it is out of the order of nature. Any upheaval in the universe is terrifying because it so profoundly attacks one sense of one's own reality. Well, the black man, black folks, have functioned in the white man's world as a fixed star, as an immovable pillar. And as he moves out of his place, heaven and earth are shaken to their foundation. What that to me again reads is like, as I'm really writing and I'm thinking about curriculum development, I'm thinking about what it means to send students out after they graduate, what do I tell them? How do I stay extremely honest with them about the world they're going to be experiencing? Because in many ways, many of our students have created extremely important and safe and safer and brave spaces at their institutions. But I'm not going to be there when they deal with extreme biases in their workplace, in their relationships, in their lives. And so I really think about what that letter means. And I think that we have to also come at the work with compassion and empathy. Mm-hmm. And even as people who have multiple marginalized identities in the work of higher education, it can be really annoying, right? When, like, I have to, like, empathize with a racist or empathize with a sexist or a transphobic person. But for them, right? And again, like, when he says that in the letter, once we move out of our place, all hell and heaven start to shake and shatter. And I think of this idea or the name that Black Lives Matter is something that terrifies people in this country. Same thing with our work. We've got to center our voices. We've got to be a little bit louder. We've got to proclaim that we're here. And we also have to be empathetic in this work as well.
I love that you shared both a resource and a recommendation that we have humor and that we laugh as a part of this work and as a part of our lives.
Yeah.
And that you shared this beautiful, profound piece from James Baldwin that will leave me thinking for days. And I'm sure people listening to this podcast as well. And I'll link both of those in the show notes so that people can have easy access to the brilliance that you just shared.
Thank you.
Yeah. As we close out, I have two questions left for you, and they're not small by any means. Mm-hmm. The first one is, what has been that big lesson that you've learned in your professional life?
To slow down and to be nicer to myself with the same expectations that I have for everybody else. And maybe I'm speaking to issues of internalized oppression, right? Or maybe I'm speaking to the need for us to be perfect in our work. But if you actually think about it, a lot of us in our education, we oftentimes give a lot of folks room to breathe and to live, but we don't give ourselves that. So I've learned in this work, what does it mean to actually be nice to myself? And what I've had to do, because I'm a visual person, I would put up little notepads on my computer. They have like little nice sayings, you know, to myself, like I'm worth it, like, or I belong here, or I can take a moment if I need to. That is one of them that is a lesson that I am still learning to practice. I'm still also learning what it means to not believe everything you hear on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And it's not about being paranoid or not about being distrustful, but not taking everything at face value. But I think that we must be able to kind of do our own research, paying extreme attention, reading between the lines to receive the messages that are actually happening around us. I know a lot of institutions, a lot of colleges are dealing with a lot of different like cuts and setbacks right now, right? And want to stay in our work. But I think we have to really be careful and be mindful about what is being told to us in this work. So take that however you want it. Be mindful and also give yourself some credit. It's a terrible thing, but it's been coming up a lot lately. Like, what's that quote? Give me the strength of like a mediocre white man. Mm-hmm. And to me, like, that's actually moving heaven and earth. Like, the idea that, like, mm-hmm. I can just relax. Like, I could just do my work. I can take off work and not worry about people thinking I'm lazy. That in itself is, to me, a pretty radical notion. Sometimes feels very impossible. But this is a funny thing I've been sitting with a lot lately.
Yeah, I think that's so beautiful that you are acknowledging all these different facets that are all together part of some bigger lesson in both personal and professional well-being. And it's as much as we try to say there's some formula for it or there's one secret ingredient, you know, there's really not. We both have shared these moments of doubt and then we have to check in with each other, be that mirror for each other.
You really cannot separate them out. You can be really cute and try. And when I mean them, I mean your profession and being able to understand student development theory and also how you feel in general with your overall health. You can't split them apart. We are not machines. Our students are not machines, right? We've got to pay attention. We've got to pay attention to ourselves in this work. We really do. I mean, and I'm sure you have. I know the majority of us have, even listening. We've seen people burn out. Like burn out in this work because they oftentimes don't pay attention to what they're doing. They're not paying attention to their bodies. They're trying to live up to expectations of everybody else around them.
Jason, what's that one piece of guidance you would give to other professionals doing equity and inclusion work today?
Mm-hmm. Don't forget to find the joy. It's really real. Like really find the joy. Find those little moments. Like when, funny, I had a little lunch date with Savvy one day, who came to the university, and I had a really busy day. I had a lot going on. I had to present, I had to do it. And then, you know, you, Savvy, came and you had a meeting with me where you had me color. It was like kind of images and shapes of like celebrating or naming or appreciating those who we lost in the Orlando, Florida shooting at the Pulse nightclub. And those moments are so massive, right? Those funny jokes I have with students and comments and dialogues, the joys and privileges of even having a position, like finding the joy in your work is so crucial, and people around you. And the really big piece of advice I would say is that change happens constantly. It does. You can't stop it. You won't stop it. And the only thing I think we have control over is ourselves. And this is some advice that is also really real to me, is that progress is subjective. It's in the eye of the beholder. Because when we make changes in the work that we're doing, in the world that we're doing, and some people say, oh, you know, there's a lot of progress made for the queer and trans communities and on college campuses, but oftentimes those same changes can really impact and silence queer and trans people. So be really mindful about what that looks like, even the language that we use. I don't know if a lot of the younger professionals in higher education know who Ani DeFranco is, sort of kind of queer, like 90s, 2000-y, like folk singer, but she wrote in one of her lyrics is that you've got to live wide enough to see the humor and long enough to see some change. That's a piece of advice that I would like to leave here with it, because you have to live light enough, right, in order to kind of be in it, to stay in it. That's that kind of self-care-ish part. And you also have to understand that systems and things take time. And I am an impatient person, so trust me when I tell you, I'm telling the audience, whoever's listening, that things take time. I'm telling you that, but I'm also telling myself that. We've got to be here long enough. We've got to fight long enough to see those things happen.
Absolutely. That's a great piece of advice within it, is that we have to tell each other and remind each other when we get a little impatient.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So, Jason, I love that you brought joy into the conversation, because when I think of you, I think of the word joy and the feelings associated with it, because you're just such a pleasure to be around. As we close out and other folks listening to this podcast want to connect with you and add you to their network, how can they go about doing
that? You can find me on LinkedIn. That's the best way, but I'll be more than happy to connect with people. It's the work that I do. It's the work that I love. Stay fierce, people.
I'll put that link so that people can connect with you and also see the joy that emanates from your daily being. Jason, thanks so much for being with me today and really influencing the lives of people listening in on this podcast and being such a positive influence on mine as well. And I know it's just a small token of my gratitude, but for the time that I know that you prepared for this and for the time that we spent on this call, I want to send you a little token, and it's this really fly flash drive that I had specially printed for a small group of folks.
Yeah.
So I'm going to send that to you. Maybe I'll hopefully get to hand it to you in person since we live so close to each other. Thanks so much. I really appreciate you.
I really appreciate you too. And the work that you're doing with Resilient Campus is so crucial and so important. And I think that a lot of professionals in this work need to hear and need to express and need another outlet. And this is another great one. So thank you so much, Savvy.
Please, folks listening in on this podcast, connect with Jason. He's amazing. I want to close out this episode with an inspirational quote to send you all back out into the world. Today's quote comes from Janet Mock. I've learned that none of us should reach for normal. Normal is so basic. To all those listening in, thank you so much for all that you do. I truly appreciate you. Stay resilient. Thanks so much for tuning in. Head on over to iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher to subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss out on a single episode.